My name is Paul Weber. As with all of the teleclasses in this series, this one is made possible in a large part by financial support from Johnson Diversey and the intellectual support of my teleclass co-founder, Dr. Syed Sattar. I hope that you someday have a chance to meet Dr. Sattar and the folk from Johnson Diversey. They're really good people and good to work with. Dr. Michelle Alpha has been very patient with me as I organized this teleclass, even though I managed to consistently misspell her name. Until recently, she has worked at Wayne State University in the College of Pharmacy and Applied Health Professions, although she has since made the move back to Winnipeg, Manitoba. She's received several Most Outstanding Teacher Awards and participates on several executive boards and committees for the American Academy of Microbiology, the Canadian College of Microbiologists, the Canadian Association of Clinical Microbiology and Infectious Disease, and a bunch of others. I'm very pleased that she's able to present with us today. The topic today is reprocessing of medical devices, and I'll turn everything over to Dr. Michelle Alpha. Michelle.
Thanks, Paul, for the introduction. If I'm speaking too low, Paul, let me know, but I'll assume everybody can hear properly. I feel in some ways like the, what do they call it, the cleanup batter, as I'm the last in the 2002 series, so a very onerous task to live up to, but I'm hoping
that...
You're
the best to last.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I'll pretend that, right? I wanted to welcome everybody, and in particular, I wanted to welcome the group from Trail BC. You really hit a chord in my heart. That was where I was actually born, so welcome to everybody, and particularly Trail. Today's topic that I'm going to be talking about is reprocessing of medical devices, and many of you may have heard some of my presentations before. I'm determined that I will leave 10 minutes at the end so that we can have discussion, because I know it's a very controversial area, and some of the information I'm going to present today I'm hoping will stimulate some questions, because there's a lot of unknowns, I think, that are related to medical device reprocessing. In addition, I did receive a couple of questions before the presentation, and I will try to work in responses to those as I go through this. So without any further ado, you've already seen slide number one, and I would make the comment that, you know, they tell me that if I keep moving as quickly as I do every few years, nobody will really know where I am, and I'll be safe from any bad questions that come up. So if I could get you to look at slide number two, I'm going to just give an overview of what I would like to address in today's session, and I am going to be biased, and I'm going to focus a lot of my attention on the narrow-lumened medical devices, because I believe those are the ones that create the biggest difficulty with respect to safe reprocessing. So I'm going to talk about the cleaning and what are the basic considerations in cleaning. I'm going to touch on the issue, which is very controversial, of manual versus automated cleaning of medical devices. And I'm also going to touch briefly on infection transmission that are associated with improper reprocessing of medical devices. And finally, what I'd like to do is look at some aspects of developing critical evaluation of published information. One of the biggest difficulties I think that's out there is when people get articles on cleaning and reprocessing of medical devices, and being a critical consumer and knowing what to look for in terms of specific methods or specific interpretation that will allow you to make sense of all the data that is out there. Because there's some very good data there, and there's also some that I tend to think of it, I heard this joke, statistics is like a bikini. It's not what it reveals that's important, it's what it hides that's critical. And I think when you're reading manuscripts and papers, it's important to know what are the critical pieces of information to look for so that you can get the take-home messages that really are important from them. Moving on, if you can look at slide number three, device reprocessing, if we just look at it from a general context, and most of us are familiar with the Spaulding classification, and what I've done is diagrammatically represent a flow chart that I think encompasses basically the flow of medical devices. The device, regardless of what it is, will initially be cleaned, and that can be either manually or automated, and sometimes that also may encompass a decontamination step while it's being cleaned, such as a washer disinfector. Once the device has been cleaned, it then is going to follow one of the three paths that I've identified by the arrows. One of them may be that it will be packaged for terminal sterilization, and the sterilization method used for a packaged device could incorporate either steam sterilization, if it can withstand that, or it will be sterilized by one of the low-temperature methods, which would include ethylene oxide gas sterilization or plasma sterilization. The other group and the other box that I put on slide number 3 is to indicate that there are a number of devices that don't actually get packaged per se during their disinfection sterilization process. And those are the ones that undergo high-level disinfection, and that would usually include a liquid such as 2% glutaraldehyde. And then the fourth category is really those that get what is called point-of-use sterilization, and that would be using the liquid chemical system such as the peracetic acid system in the STERIS System 1. That overviews the process of the flow of all medical devices. Now, I've put two asterisks beside the steam sterilization in this diagram, and the reason for that is to emphasize that if a device can withstand steam sterilization, that is obviously the preferred method. Now, that seems inherently obvious and probably doesn't need emphasis, but one of the most important things in an institution is to make sure that you assess your stream of flow for medical devices, because sometimes you will find that devices are being put through ETO or plasma sterilization that can actually take steam sterilization, and steam is obviously the most effective, cheapest, and has the biggest buffer of safety in terms of a methodology. The one take-home message from this slide is, obviously, if it isn't clean, it can't be properly sterilized or disinfected no matter which of these paths you take. And so for the majority of the rest of my talk today, what I am going to focus on really is the cleaning aspect of it, because most of the problems that we run into with infection transmission usually stem from the fact that the device has been inadequately cleaned and has basically overwhelmed the sterilization or disinfection methodology that was subsequently used on it. The other way or method, I guess, that infection transmission occurs is if an inappropriate disinfection or sterilization method is used. But or one of the pivotal points, in my opinion, is the cleaning of medical devices. And so I'm going to focus most of my discussion on that aspect. If you can turn to slide number 4, I've already prefaced my talk by saying that the difficult to clean medical devices, there's tons of them out there. We've all had our own experiences and frustration with any number of these devices. But the one aspect of devices that does make it extremely difficult are those that are narrow lumened. And in that category, I would include flexible endoscopes, and I would also include things like the gastrointestinal or GI accessory devices such as sphincter tomes and biopsy forceps. These devices, the endoscopes themselves, have very narrow lumens, and they have very complex paths within the channels that run throughout the length of these flexible endoscopes. And if it is a side-viewing ERCP endoscope, the mechanical lever that's used to position the accessory devices is also a challenge in terms of the cleaning. Other challenges that present when you're trying to clean a device are the hinged or serrated edges, and certainly the laparoscopic devices used for minimally invasive surgical procedures fit that bill. I can remember many years ago going into the OR, one of the hospitals I was at, and the nurses that were there were showing me some of these laparoscopic devices, not the laparoscope itself, but the laparoscopic accessory devices, the scissors, the graspers, etc. And she was showing me a device that had gone through the best cleaning that they could do, and it was one of those devices that could not be disassembled and had no port. And she said, look at this, and she held it upright and tapped it, and bloody material dripped out the end of it. And that was after following the accepted methodology for cleaning these devices. And so laparoscopic devices present a unique challenge, and I'm going to present some data today to show you some of the studies we've done looking at the cleaning issues of these devices. And the other big favorite of mine, and I'm sure yours too, is the non-ported GI biopsy forceps. Whether you are using single-use biopsy forceps and you're reprocessing them, or you are using reusable biopsy forceps, you will find that they do not have lure ports that allow access to the inside of the biopsy forceps. And it is a huge challenge in terms of trying to even get any fluid flow inside of those devices and get proper cleaning. Now, the Canadian situation, we are still reprocessing a lot of single-use devices. In the States, it's slightly different because of the FDA regulations and the change in overseeing the reuse of single-use devices. Having worked in Michigan, we did a survey there, and I know that what's happening in the States is there are not many hospitals that are reprocessing single-use devices, but what is happening is many of the single-use devices are being sent to third-party reprocessors. And I think the issues related to cleaning, whether the device is a single-use device or a reusable device, the cleaning issues are basically the same. And you're going to see some data today to substantiate what I'm saying. Now, obviously, within the groups of difficult-to-clean medical devices, those that are critical, those that are going to go into a sterile body cavity, are those that pose the highest risk of infection transmission. And obviously, they're the ones we're most concerned about. It's interesting to me, though, that even with critical devices such as laparoscopic devices, there is often a push, instead of using sterilization and reprocessing them, to use high-level disinfection. And I know there are sites out there that use glutaraldehyde and other high-level disinfectants for the reprocessing of laparoscopic devices, and it is one of the areas of controversy in reprocessing of medical devices, whether that is an acceptable protocol or not, and I think the judgment is still out on that. Some sites use it, some don't, and there's controversy surrounding it. Now, if you move on to slide number 5, if you look at medical device cleaning, and I know I probably sound pedantic, but I think it's something that is worth going over. You know, what does medical device cleaning really mean? What's out there in terms of giving us guidance for what we should be striving to achieve in terms of cleaning medical devices? Now, if you look at, when I use the word soil, I'm talking about patient secretions or material that has been put onto the medical device, usually through use in a patient, and it could include things such as blood, serum, mucus from the mucosal surfaces, and it could also include things from the environment that have gotten onto the device because of handling and placement within the environment. So when I say soil, I'm usually referring to that aspect of it. A component that is also present in the soil that devices get exposed to could also include bioburden, which is the next term that I put on that slide. And you can see when I talk about bioburden, it's pretty apparent that if you're doing a clean surgery and you're using sterile surgical instruments, if you looked at assessing what is the soil and bioburden after surgical procedure, there certainly would be soil on those devices because patient secretions, blood, etc., would be on them. One would not expect huge microbial loads or bioburdens because it would be a sterile body cavity that the device has been introduced into. And studies have shown, Chu et al. Demonstrated that for surgical instruments, the load of microorganisms is usually between 10 to the 1 to 10 to the 3, so between 10 to 1,000 organisms per device. And there is quite a range. Most of the devices would have very low microbial levels. And the interesting thing about those devices is that when you put them in and wash them with tap water in the reprocessing area, that low level of microorganisms doesn't necessarily get removed and you end up with zero organisms. Usually what happens is if the bioburden is low initially and you're washing them in tap water in a regular environment, you actually replace them with water organisms during the washing process. The load of organisms still remains very low, but it's interesting that you are substituting water and environmental organisms for organisms that were accumulated during the handling or the surgical procedure. Now, if we look at mucosal surfaces, and we look at what are endoscope lumens exposed to, the range of organisms is in a totally different ballpark. You're looking at between 10 to the 4 to 10 to the 9 colony-forming units, or CFUs, per device. And about 75% of endoscope lumens will have this very high load of microorganisms. And the point I'm making with this is cleaning is obviously very different when you're looking at cleaning of a surgical instrument that's easy to clean compared to a surgical instrument that is difficult to clean with narrow lumens, etc. And the third difference would be when you're looking at flexible endoscopes and the load of organisms may be very, very high. And the bottom line is that the expectation that's out there, and I know this number has been bandied about a lot, and I'm going to present some data today that I think will be quite controversial. The bandied about number is that cleaning should remove between 3 to 4 log to the base 10 of organisms. And what that means is that when you get cleaning, you should be able to eradicate up to about 4 logs of organisms just from physical removal due to the cleaning process. And I was quite excited. There was a recent article that just came out in the Journal of Hospital Infection, and I'm going to share some of this data with you later, that demonstrates that at least in the endoscope washer that they evaluated, none of the cleaners that they used affected anywhere near a 4-log reduction of organisms. So I think that's going to provide some interesting information for us to talk about. But again, the take-home message is what you can't see can hurt you. And the reason I put that phrase in there is because right now, if we look at what's out there in the guidelines to use as a measure of when you get the appropriate level of cleaning, you're going to find that there's an assumption that as long as it's visibly clean, it's adequately cleaned. And as a microbiologist, I would argue with that that's not necessarily true. So if you move on to slide number 6, this is talking about non-ported medical devices. And basically what I would like to do is turn my attention to this aspect of things because it is a very difficult area in most centers, and we all struggle with how to cope with that. And by non-ported medical devices, I'm referring to things like biopsy forceps. Whether they're single-use or reusable, they do not have a port that allows you to flush the inner workings of the biopsy forceps. The other types of devices that are non-ported that many of us have and contend with are the laparoscopic devices used for minimally invasive surgery. There are still devices out there that are non-dismantleable and do not have ports, and they present special challenges. Now, if you look at the manufacturer's recommendation for reprocessing of this type of medical device, and I'm talking about the non-ported medical devices, usually there are a number of things that are recommended. Sonication is certainly one of those, and we all know that sonication is designed to sonic vibrations loosen the soil and organisms from the surface of a device so that it can be properly cleaned away. The second aspect that is always recommended is the use of a detergent. And in many instances, enzymatic detergents are the ones that are recommended for device cleaning, both for flexible endoscope, for accessory devices, and for surgical instruments. And I've put a little note there, enzymatic versus activated hydrogen peroxide products, because I'm going to talk about that a little bit later, but I wanted to remind you that when we talk about detergents, there are detergents that are enzymatic, which means they have enzymes in them that can break down proteins, there's lipases, there's other enzymatic components that can theoretically break down the soil components, including carbohydrates, fats, proteins, starches, and the philosophy there is that if you break these components down, it'll make them easier to remove. The other group of detergents would be those that would be categorized as chemical detergents. And within that group, I would include activated hydrogen peroxide, and there are a number of other chemical detergents that can be used for medical device cleaning as well. Now, the third bullet on that slide is a critical one, the idea that there should be rinsing to remove the detergent. And we sometimes forget that the enzymatic detergents are actually protein solutions, and that's very different than the chemical detergents. In either case, you need to remove that material before it goes on to the next stage, which would be disinfection or sterilization. And in particular, for enzymatic detergents, it's critical that it gets removed, because otherwise those proteins remain on the device. And if the device then gets put into, for instance, a glutaraldehyde solution, those proteins are going to be fixed on the surface of the device. And so I raise that to remind you that enzymes are proteins, and that if you don't adequately remove them by rinsing with water, you could be creating problems when it reaches the next stage. It could interfere with the disinfection or sterilization. Now, the last bullet on this slide is that in many of the guidelines, and we've all faced this frustration, we all know cleaning is pivotal. We all know we want to do the best job, but there's not many guidelines out there to give us guidance as to how clean is clean enough. And currently, APIC guidelines and many of the other ones recommend that at least the device should be visually clean. In other words, with the eyesight, you should be able to look at it and say that it's visually clean. And there are publications out there and guidelines that also recommend it is a good idea to have a magnifying glass or some means of facilitating the visual inspection so that you're looking at the devices with more than just the unaided eye. Now, it's interesting to me that we look at this and we tell people to clean medical devices, and the guidelines we give them are to make sure that they're visually clean, and we tout the idea that cleaning should remove 3 to 4 logs of microorganisms. There was a recent manuscript that came out by Zulsdorf et al., and it came out of Germany. It's published in the Journal of Hospital Infection in 2002, and it's volume 52, and it's page 206 to 211. What they did was look at the cleaning efficacy of 9 different cleaners in a washer disinfector that was designed for flexible endoscopes. And when I looked at the methodology that they used, I think I professionally believe it was a good methodology. They didn't give the specifics about which washer disinfector they were using. We all know in North America there are no endoscope washer disinfectors that have been approved by FDA to do the cleaning of flexible endoscopes. All the guidelines require that manual cleaning be done first, and then they're put in an endoscope washer disinfector. And even if you've got a wash cycle on your endoscope reprocessor, the requirement is that you do manual cleaning first. That's not the same, and in some of the German countries, certainly there is a reliance on the cleaning cycle in some of these endoscope reprocessors. This paper doesn't spell out which machine they're using for endoscope cleaning, but it does state that it has no connectors. The biopsy port, the air water channel, etc., are not hard connected to the actual washer disinfector. It's a type of washer disinfector that uses a pressure chamber, and it theoretically forces liquid down those channels because of the pressure in the chamber. So I preface it by reminding you that that's the kind of washer that's being used. But what I found most interesting in this one was I have felt this for years, and it was very good to see this paper come out with data. They used a surrogate tubing of the same dimensions as a flexible endoscope. They put blood and enterococcus in the mixture and allowed it to actually coagulate in they kept it open so that it didn't plug the channel, but they allowed it to coagulate just like normal blood would if you were doing a procedure. And then they looked at the cleaning efficacy from both a visual cleaning perspective and also from a microbial load reduction in viable organisms. And they looked at it in both soft water and hard water. And what I found fascinating, and I'm going to talk about the hard water data, not one of the 9 detergents that they used was able to effect even a 3-log reduction in microorganisms. And I think that this brings us or gives us some data that raises the question about the efficacy of some of the detergents when they're basically used alone by themselves. Now, remember, there would be no brushing of these channels, and that's standard procedure in flexible endoscopes. And it's really only assessing how good the machine's wash cycle is in combination with different detergents. And they tested 6 enzymatic detergents and 3 chemical detergents. And the reason I'm taking a bit of time to go over this is because I think there's very little data out there that does good scientific comparison of enzymatics and chemicals and what efficacy they really have in terms of their ability to remove soil and to remove organisms. The authors of this paper basically also stated that there were combinations that also didn't even get the devices visibly clean, that there was problems even from a visible cleaning perspective. And they basically indicated that there's variability in the cleaning process and the ability to achieve this 4-log reduction that is an expectation in at least North American requirements was quite interesting to me. They go on to say they don't recommend abandoning cleaning agents, but they identify that there needs to be more research done in this area. And I would agree with that. I think you need to be very cognizant of the issues about cleaning, and when you're using enzymatics, to make sure they're used following the manufacturer's guidelines in terms of temperature and the length of exposure time for it. Now, if we move on to slide number seven, this is my I couldn't help but include the picture of the pig in here, visual inspection of cleaning. And we might look at a pig looking inside its container and say, well, you know, obviously that pig can't assess cleanliness. But this pig has one advantage over us when we try to look at flexible endoscopes. At least this pig can look inside of the container and visually inspect it. When it comes to narrow lumen devices, we are at the mercy of the device because we cannot visually inspect the inside. We can only inspect the outside. So the guidelines requiring visual inspection are a good first step, but they're by no means a totally foolproof and adequate step. And if we move on to slide number 8, that is my introduction to the issue of manual versus automated cleaning. And if we look at some of the devices like laparoscopic devices and sphincterotomes, the issues are that you should be using sonication to try to loosen the soil so that it can be removed. Fluid flow and access of that is obviously critical, and the volume of fluid you're putting through such narrow lumen devices is also critical. And those are the points that I would like to consider as I go through talking about some of the data that I'm going to present in the next set of slides, because they're the crux of, is manual good enough or is automated good enough, or are we being fooled by putting things in an automated cleaner when we think we're doing a good job and in actuality we fail to consider some critical aspects. So if you move on to slide number 9, I want to present data, and I'm not giving a session to promote any device or any detergent, but I want to at least let you know what was used in this one. We did a study with narrow lumen devices, and we used the Sonic Irrigator Auto, which is a narrow lumen cleaner produced by MediSafe, and there's a picture of it there for you to see. What I'd like you to see is that the baskets inside the unit have ports that allow you to connect narrow lumen devices to it. And I've shown a picture of a laparoscopic device and a sphincterotome in this slide. And I've also showed you a little plastic cylindrical chamber with the title retroflushing. And I would like to explain that because the results are presented that way. The unit has a little adapter that has a gasket in it. Where my fingers are in that picture, there's actually a gasket. And the distal end of the sphincterotome is threaded into this chamber, and then fluid, it's attached by the distal, like the port end that you see at the far end of the plastic chamber, is connected by a tubing to the port inside the narrow lumen cleaning device. And what that does is it forces liquid up the distal end of any narrow lumen device you put inside the adapter. And it's a very snug gasket fit, so it ensures fluid flow goes down it, whether it's a laparoscopic device that's non-ported or whether it's a device like a sphincterotome. Now, we used this approach to do a study, and what we did was, I'm going to present the data first for laparoscopic devices, and if you turn to slide number 10, what I did was take non-ported laparoscopic devices and compared them to ported laparoscopic devices. And we tested a variety of cleaning methods, which are listed on the bottom of the slide. The graphs or the bars, the histograms shown in under number 1 are uncleaned laparoscopic devices. They were soiled with organisms, but they were not cleaned. And that is to assess the recoverable load of organisms that we have. And we loaded them with Enterococcus faecalis and Bacillus erythromophilus in a soil that mimics the types of soils these devices would be exposed to in use. Now, the Roman numeral 2, the bars over Roman numeral 2, represent the organisms that remained after manual cleaning. And you'll notice on the graph that the y-axis represents log to the base 10 CFUs per device. That's how much is detected inside the device after whatever process we did. And Roman numeral number 2, those two bars, represent the load of organisms that were inside the laparoscopic device after manual cleaning. Manual cleaning was immersing it in the same enzymatic detergent that's used in the automated machine, washing it, trying to flush fluid up the distal end using a little syringe without a needle on it, and then rinsing it. Roman numeral number 3 is taking the laparoscopic device, putting it into the SI auto, but the ported devices were connected and the non-ported devices could not be connected, so they were just laid in, and that would be the equivalent of doing sonication only and manual and doing cleaning by an automated cleaner. Roman numeral number 5 is putting the laparoscopic device in that little retroflushing chamber and then connecting it to the SI auto so there is fluid being flushed up the lumen. And Roman numeral number 5 represents the negative control. Now, if you look at those numbers, you will see that manual cleaning does not reduce the load of organisms inside a non-ported device at all. And even if you put it in the SI auto, a non-ported device cannot be connected. And you will see that under, for instance, Roman numeral number 3, you will see that there's no reduction in the microbial levels, even though you've put it in a machine that's sonicating it and flushing large volumes of fluid over the outside of the laparoscopic device. Only when we use retroflushing do we get a few log reduction. And even then, we get maybe a 3-log reduction of organisms. When you compare that to the graph on the right, which is the same experimental protocol using ported devices, you will see that ported devices, whether you're cleaning them manually or in the automated machine, are much easier to clean. The microbial reduction is much easier to achieve even with manual cleaning because you're flushing down the port. And you will see that when you put it in the SI auto and you connect it via the port, which is Roman numeral number 3 on the right-hand graph, B, you see that you've definitely achieved a 4-log reduction of organisms, both Enterococcus faecalis and B. sterothermophilus. And it is equivalent. Whether you retroflush or use the port connection, you get good cleaning and good removal of organisms. What the take-home message from this is, those non-ported devices, if you are manually cleaning them or you're using even sonication with an automated machine and you're not using retroflushing, you're not getting much cleaned out of the inner portion of a laparoscopic device. The ported devices are obviously much easier to clean no matter which method you use, but in the instance of even ported devices, the automated units get much better cleaning than if you did manual cleaning. And that's because the volume of fluid flowing through an automated unit is far higher than what you're going to get with manual flushing. Now, if you turn to slide number 11, this is the same experimental protocol, but in this case, we're looking for protein removal instead of microbial log reductions. And I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this graph, but I want to point out to you that in the left-hand graph that is the non-ported one, it's called A, if you look at those that are under Roman numeral 3, you will see that the laparoscopic non-ported devices, even if they're put into a machine that sonicates them, you will see the protein levels are still very high inside that laparoscopic device, and that's pretty obviously why that is. It's because there just isn't the fluid flow, and even though you're sonicating it and lifting the soil, there's no fluid flow, so you're not flushing it out. Whereas you see under Roman numeral number 4 on graph A, there is very good protein removal as soon as you do retroflushing. If, on the other hand, you're using ported devices, which you see on the right-hand side, you get very good removal of protein using retroflushing or using the port connection on the laparoscopic device. And even with manual cleaning, you're getting some protein removal. So the take-home message from this is minimally invasive surgical devices that are used in laparoscopic procedures, if you have non-ported ones, it is very critical that they are cleaned using a retroflushing method, because if you're not, what's happening is you will get a buildup of material inside those devices. And even though these laparoscopic devices usually are submitted to steam sterilization, we all know that with time there's going to be a buildup of material inside those laparoscopic devices, and even steam sterilization can fail if there's enough crud inside of the device. So the recommendation I would have is that non-ported devices that are used for laparoscopic procedures really should be phased out, and we should be looking at using dismantleable devices or ported laparoscopic devices. Now, if we move on to slide number 12, I'm going to show you some data very similar in some respects in terms of the experimental approach, but we're looking at sphincterotomes this time. This has a lot of relevance in the Canadian group because I know there are many sites that are reprocessing single-use sphincterotomes, and the most common sphincterotomes that are now being used are the ones that are triple lumen. And you'll see in this diagram, I know when I first started doing research in this area back in the early 1990s, there were single-lumen sphincterotomes, and we've progressed through to the point where the most commonly used ones now are triple lumen. And the picture at the bottom of your figure, the long, narrow plastic tube that is coming out that forms the sphincterotome is actually solid plastic that's extruded, and in the inside of it there are three holes, or channels, if you will, that run up the entire length of the device. In the bottom picture, you can see my hands, and I've cut through the handle of this sphincterotome, and I hope you appreciate how tiny those channels. There's three channels in there, but they're obviously very, very tiny. If you look at the picture above my hands, you'll see that this is a single-use sphincterotome. It has two lure ports, and they access the dye injection channel and the guide wire channel, but there is no port to access the cautery wire channel. And it doesn't take rocket science. Based on what I've shown you on the non-ported laparoscopic devices, you can guess what's going to happen when we soil this device and then look at the cleaning. And if you turn to slide number 13, this is just a summary of how we actually soiled the devices. We used a little retroflushing adapter as our method to force the soil. You'll see in the second picture in slide number 13, you'll see the red fluid inside the adapter. And what we do is we used a syringe to force that fluid up into all three channels in the sphincterotome. And we would hold that at room temperature for an hour, flush it out with air just to remove the excess soil, and then we process it by the cleaning methods. And the cleaning methods we used are very similar to what I described to you for the laparoscopic data that I presented. Now, in order to access each of the three lumens inside the sphincterotome, we cut the handle off, and I call them L1, L2, and L3. That's just to represent there are three channels. And what we did was use a needle that fit very snugly into each of the lumens. And we use that needle that you can see in the bottom part of the picture. There's three needles that are inserted into each of the channels, and that allows us to flush fluid out and to instill reagents into the channel. And we did a couple of types of tests. One of them is called an in situ test, which means that we instilled Bradford's reagent into each of the channels. And Bradford reagent is unique in that if there's protein present, the reagent will turn blue. And, of course, you have to incubate it for 20 minutes or a number of minutes for it to react and change blue. What we then did was we would draw out the Bradford's reagent from L1, separate from L2, separate from L3, and we would read the absorbance from each of those channels after cleaning to see was there any residual protein that stayed inside each of those channels. And if you turn to slide number 14, you'll see the results of simulated use testing with sphincterotomes. We soiled the sphincterotomes, and we did Bradford's testing, as I've just described to you. Now, you'll see that the graph I'm presenting on the y-axis, the absorbance goes from 0 to 1.2. The higher the absorbance, the more the blue color had developed. And the higher the blue color, it means that there was more protein detected. So if you see a zero on the y-axis, it means there was no protein there. If you see a high absorbance, it means there was quite a bit of protein there because the color change was very intense. And what we did was we separated L1 from L2 from L3, and you can see that under the histograms labeled A, there are three bars there. L1 is represented by the darkest color. The middle bar represents the second lumen, and the third bar in that cluster represents the third lumen. And what you will notice is that for the group called A, they're the non-cleaned ones, soiled but non-cleaned. Every one of them shows protein, which we expect. If we go under group number B, that's where the device was manually cleaned, and you'll see that L1, which is the cautery wire channel, still has lots of protein in it. L2, which is the dye injection channel, also has some small amount of protein in it. L3, which is the biggest, which is the guide wire channel, had no detectable protein with manual cleaning. If we look at C, these sphincterotomes were put in the sonic irrigator, but obviously you can only connect them via the two ports that are there. And L1, which doesn't have a port to allow you to connect, still has residual protein in it even after going through the automated cleaning machine cycle. L2 had nothing in it, and L3 had nothing in it when it was put through that cycle, and that makes sense because those were connected to the ports, and they were connected to get good fluid flow through each of those lumens. If we did retroflushing, which is group number D, you'll see that all three channels get well cleaned using retroflushing, and there's no detectable protein in them. The take-home message is the same as what it was for the laparoscopic devices. If you don't get fluid flow through all of the channels, you will not remove the protein or soil from these devices. Now, the second test that we did, we wanted to look at the removal of organisms, because just because you remove protein and carbohydrate doesn't necessarily you're doing a good job with organisms. And if you turn to slide 15, the method that we used here, and I won't spend a lot of time with it, but it is important. We used a destructive testing method, and we did it in a way that ensured every one of the little lumens was full of fluid and that we adequately eluted our sample from it. Because with indirect testing like this, you have to be very careful to remove everything so that when you do your counts, they reliably reflect what was inside each of those lumens. I won't walk you through the method, but it's there for you to look at, and it's been designed scientifically to make sure that we've done the best job we can to test every lumen. The reason I'm harping on this is there's publications in the literature where people have flushed fluid through the ports of sphincterotomes via the lure port, and they say they get no detectable organisms and claim that's the basis that they should be allowed to reprocess sphincterotomes. But you notice the cautery wire channel has no port. Those papers can't even sample that port. So unless they do destructive testing, they wouldn't even know what was inside the cautery wire channel. Again, one of those little clues, when you're looking at data in the literature and they're talking about cleaning of devices, look at the methods they use. Do they use destructive testing, or do they use just a flushing of fluid through the channel? Okay, if you move on to slide 16, these are the results of the soil removal. And the take-home message is very, very similar to what I've been talking about previously, and that is that if you look at the four graphs that I put on there, one is showing protein parameters, and you'll see that manual cleaning does remove some of the protein. The SI Auto, using the ported parts of the sphincterotome, there is still residual protein, and that's likely because the protein remains in that L1 channel, that's the cautery wire channel, and only when we use retroflushing do we actually clean out the protein. That same message is reiterated for hemoglobin, carbohydrate, and endotoxin. You'll see that in every case, when you do retroflushing of this triple lumen sphincterotome, you get good removal of the soil components. If you do not connect all of the channels or get fluid flow through all of the channels, you do not get good cleaning. And if we move on to slide number 17, this is showing you the viable counts. And this relates back to some of the expectations of cleaning. If you look at slide number 17, on the y-axis is the colony-forming units per device, and this is based on log to the base 10 values. On the x-axis, again, it's that same grouping of A, B, C, D, E, where A is a non-cleaned sphincterotome, and you can see that there's 7 to 8 logs of Enterococcus faecalis and B. stereothermophilus inside these devices if we don't clean them. If you look under B, when we do manual cleaning, even though the manual cleaning did reduce some of the protein and carbohydrate levels, you'll see it isn't doing a huge amount in terms of reducing the microbial levels, because the load of organisms in that cautery wire channel, that L1 channel, obviously are still in there, and the expected reduction for cleaning is not being achieved. On group number C, this is putting it through the automated machine, but only connecting it via the existing port. So the two ports for L2 and L3 are connected, but obviously L1 doesn't have a port and you cannot connect it. And you'll see again the expected log reduction of organisms is not achieved. Only on group D, when we use retroflushing, which is forcing the fluid up the distal end of the sphincter tome, and that allows access to L1, L2, and L3, you're pushing fluid through all three channels, do you get the expected log reduction. Now, it's interesting to me, too, that even when you look at this, there are still up to 4 logs of Enterococcus faecalis that remain inside the channels of that device, despite the fact that we've used retroflushing. And it doesn't take rocket science to understand that as you reuse this device over and over, there is going to be a gradual buildup of microorganisms within those channels. And there will come a point at which the channels are going to be almost impossible to clean because there's been such a buildup that's occurred there. Now, I'd like you to move to slide number 18, and I'd like to summarize the information I've presented to date. If you look at what I've just presented, manual cleaning really has little to no impact on non-ported channels. So if you have a medical device that has a lumen in it or a central cavitary stretch that has no port to access it, when you do manual cleaning, you're fighting a losing battle because you can't get fluid flow up there. If we look at the second bullet, automated cleaning also has no impact on the non-ported channels. And I think that's a very important take-home message, because sometimes we use these fancy-dancy machines, but we fail to realize that they're not going to do the job you expect if they can't be connected and get fluid flow down the channel either. And the third bullet is the bacteria are actually the most difficult to remove from these lumens, and that was actually also reiterated by the data that I told you about from that German paper on endoscope cleaning. That was exactly what they found, too, that the organism removal is certainly, in the studies they did, nowhere near what the expected level of removal should be. The fourth bullet on slide number 18, retroflushing using automated cleaning is really the optimal method for non-ported accessory devices. And I would go one step further. I think that for laparoscopic devices, there should be a push-put to phase out any laparoscopic devices that are non-ported, because they just do not lend themselves to cleaning. And even when you use retroflushing, they're difficult to clean. And the final bullet on slide number 18 is to remember that one of the values of the automated instruments is the volume of fluid that flows through the device is much larger. I've been in areas where devices are being cleaned, and when they're manually cleaned, they certainly don't get anywhere near a liter of fluid going through them, whereas the automated machines will put large volumes through. But keep in mind, an automated machine is only as good as the maintenance you give it. And so although I'm supporting the value of automated instrumentation, remember that it in and of itself isn't the solution. You have to make sure that it's maintained properly. And I threw in at the bottom, the issues are the same for biopsy forceps because they are non-ported. So I'm not presenting data on biopsy forceps, but they're the same. I'd like you to flip to slide number 19. And if we look at infection transmission, this is now bringing the circle around full loop. If we look at laparoscopic devices, infection transmission is actually quite rare, and that is usually associated with the fact that the autoclave, they're usually autoclavable, and that it's a very robust methodology. But remember, even the autoclave can fail if the lumen is too heavily soiled. And there was a recent presentation at the APIC meeting where they were talking about knee surgery, and they found that their infection rates in knee surgery had gone up dramatically. And when they reviewed it, the method that was being used to clean their laparoscopic devices was very inappropriate. And even though they were being steam autoclaved, they felt there may be an association between the crud and grunge that was inside their laparoscopic devices and their infection rate. The second bullet there is the sphincter tomes. The rate of infection transmission is unknown. If manual cleaning is being done with single-use sphincter tomes, the cautery wire channel is a definite issue, because I have data to show that patient secretions do get up that channel, and we know if you're manually cleaning them, you're not going to be removing that material. The third item is the Olympus recall. Certainly with bronchoscopes, there is strong evidence that if they're not properly reprocessed, transmission of Pseudomonas and Mycobacterium tuberculosis can occur. And in Australia, there's been documentation of hepatitis C transmission via colonoscopy. So infection transmission does occur, albeit the rates at which it occur are not truly understood because of the lack of prospective studies. Now, slide number 20 is the issue of critical publication evaluation. And I'd like to just throw these bullets out there for you. When you're looking at data in the literature, make sure you've looked at the design of the device and asked yourself the question, are all the channels in the device accessible to fluid, and were they actually dealt with? And did the data presented give you information on all of the channels? Check to make sure there's proper positive and negative controls, that if they run them and they soil them, they show you how much organism they would get out if they didn't actually do the cleaning. And does the method use destructive or in situ testing? And please remember, when you're looking at this, there's some people that talk about, they say, okay, cleaning gave me a 3-log reduction, disinfection gave me a 6-log, and they'll add those together. You cannot do that. Remember that if the load of organisms that is high when it comes time to disinfect, you may not get a 6-log reduction, and that the issue is the entire process. You need to get data that shows, okay, from the beginning to the end, what was the log reduction. Don't separate the two processes and then just mathematically try to add them together. You can't do that. And the final thing is that spores or organisms alone are not a good indicator of cleaning efficacy. You can have organisms that have been killed by the process. They're still there. They haven't been cleaned off. And if you're using that as your indicator of cleaning, you may be misleading yourself. And if you turn to the final slide, which is 21, I hope I haven't bored you all to death. It's hard when you're doing a teleconference. You can't see people. You may all be asleep out there, and I don't know it. But I'm hoping that I've left you with the idea reprocessing of narrow lumen medical devices is a challenge, and I'm hoping that because you're attending this session, you don't take the attitude that's shown on this last slide, which is kind of see no evil, hear no evil, speak no evil. And I'm hoping that I've at least stimulated one or two questions in your mind that you will then look at within your own institution, because every time we look at the process, we improve it because we find ways to sort things out. And on that point, I'm going to stop, because I hope we have at least a few minutes for questions.
Great. Thank you very much, Dr. Elsa, Michelle. Can I ask a question? Firstly, you mentioned activated hydrogen peroxide. Is that the same as accelerated hydrogen peroxide?
Yes, I've used the word activated, but I think that the word that's used by the company is probably accelerated.
Okay, good. Well, thank you. And thank you for that. The floor is now open for questions. If you have a question, please first take yourself off of mute or we won't hear you. And then identify yourself by at least your first name and the city or facility from which you are calling. And the floor is now open.
Hello, my name is Sharon from St. John's, Newfoundland.
Hey, Sharon.
I have a question about cystoscopes and in the flexible cystoscope. Should they be sterile? When I look at the guidelines, recent ones from Health Canada, I think it has them down as sterile.
Approach that would be used, the question that was asked is the issue of cystoscopes, particularly flexible cystoscopes. And really, each center goes through and assesses it, but using the Spalding classification, what you want to look at is, does the device enter a sterile body cavity? And if it does, it should be categorized as a critical device. If it goes over mucosal surfaces, such as a flexible endoscope used for GI procedures, and doesn't actually enter a sterile body cavity, it would be considered semi-critical and require a minimum of high-level disinfection. So the cystoscopes, as I understand, are obviously going into, if I, and I'm a microbiologist, so forgive me, if the site they're going into is like the bladder or a sterile body site, it would be considered to be a critical device.
Thank you, Sharon. Is there another question?
Yes, Jerry Thomas from Prince Albert, Saskatchewan. I'm wondering, there was an issue a while back regarding possibility of the transmission of CJD through biopsy forceps being used in colonoscopes. Is there anything that you could tell us as far as guidelines of using disposable or reusable biopsy forceps?
One of the issues is to remember that the likelihood of having prions in the gastrointestinal tract for typical Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease or CJD, it really has not been found in the GI tract. What has been found in the GI tract is the issue of variant CJD or mad cow disease, and that has been found in the lymph nodes in the GI tract, and that usually is kind of where this issue comes up. So if we're talking traditional CJD, the tissues that have been sampled from patients with CJD, they don't find it in the GI tract. It's considered a non-source for CJD. With biopsy forceps, obviously if you're using single-use disposable ones, it's a non-issue. If you're using ones that are reusable, then the understanding there is, and I don't think there is a definitive position on this, the recommendation is obviously if you have a consideration for variant CJD, disposable biopsy forceps are going to solve your problem. In North America, to my knowledge, other than people coming in from other countries, like European countries that might have variant CJD, they're saying that in North America we don't really see variant CJD. So the risk is extremely rare. And that if you use disposable biopsy forceps, there is no risk because you're not reusing them. If you use reusable, I would say that you need to make sure your cleaning is being done well. That would be all that I would say on it. The risk is quite remote, but for variant CJD, it does exist. And that in that particular case, the cleaning issues for biopsy forceps, and I've already identified what they are, I would bet my bottom dollar that people reprocessing biopsy forceps, whether they're reusable or single use, probably most of them are not using retroflushing, and there probably is buildup that is occurring.
Thank you, Jerry. We've got time for maybe one, possibly two questions.
Can I speak? Brenda Latch from Scarborough Hospital General Division. I'd like to ask about the Cydex OPA. She mentioned glutaraldehyde, but what about the OPA?
Yes, actually, that was an omission in that there should have been OPA put there also as a high-level disinfectant, and certainly it is an approved high-level disinfectant that is available, certainly can be used and is used in many centers for flexible endoscopes. The one thing you have to make sure that you're doing, particularly if you're manually rinsing these after OPA exposure, make sure the rinsing is extremely thorough, because even very, very minute amounts of OPA can cause skin staining on either the patient or the people handling it. And that issue is important to pay attention to, volumes of liquid, to make sure you've got good rinsing after OPA.
The particular machine we're using says to rinse three times, and it is set to do so. So that seems to be...
If you're using an automated endoscope reprocessor, you should have no problems with the rinse aspect. It's more of a problem when people are manually rinsing, again, because they tend to use smaller volumes.
Thank you.
Folks, our time has just about come. If you have a question that you didn't get to ask, please ask it in the email that you'll be sending to me afterward along with your feedback. I'll make sure the question gets answered, and I'll post the answers on the Internet as well as sending it to you directly.
Paul, can I answer one of the questions very quickly? There was a question asked about dismantling of minimally invasive instruments prior to sterilization. Mm-hmm. And if you look in the CSA international standard, it is definitely recommended that those devices should be disassembled prior to steam sterilization and for exactly the reasons that were identified to ensure penetration. So the question they were having trouble with was they didn't want to... that some of the nurses didn't want the disassembly, but you do need to have it to make sure steam penetration is being done well.
Before we disconnect, I want to thank you for joining us today, all of you. It's been an excellent teleclass. Thanks again to Johnson Diversey for their support, and thank you, Michelle. Thanks for the time and the effort that you took to put this teleclass together. As always, you're a real pro. Thank you all again for spending this hour with us, and have a very great day. Bye-bye.